Welcome back to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm your host, Graham Richmond, and today I'm joined by Alex Brown, my colleague here at Clear Admit. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you very much for having me again, Graham.
Always a pleasure. So today we are going to talk about MBA rankings. And as many know, it's a kind of a controversial subject. People get very excited about rankings, candidates, schools, really everyone involved in the process. And so Alex and I thought it'd be really helpful to just have a conversation about the different rankings that are out there, what we think of them. One of the interesting things that I really want to underline as we kind of embark on this survey of different rankings is that we know quite a bit about this, and that's not to toot our own horn, but as many of you know who read our site and pay attention to the Clear Admit community, we are privy to a really heavy stream of data and information on candidates and their preferences, thanks to some of the tools on our website. And so we obviously have a point of view on this. I should mention, Alex previously worked in MBA admissions as a senior associate director at Wharton. He was also head of admissions at University of Delaware. So has seen, the MBA admissions process and understands rankings and has been in the space for many years. I also worked at Wharton and have been doing this for a while. So we have a lot of opinions around rankings, and we're kind of excited to walk through. So Alex, do you want to talk a little bit about just the history here and, some of, back when you were at U Delaware or back at Wharton in the early days, what were the rankings that people paid attention to? And maybe give us a little bit of the history.
Sure. Actually, when I was at Wharton, so we're talking, I think, that the late 1990s, early 2000s, Wharton was actually the number one school in the world, and that was according to Business Week. And at that time, Business Week ranked biannually, I think that's the right term, every second year. So I think Wharton took the prize a couple of times in a row. I think Kellogg had the number one at one point during that time frame too. But it was a big deal for the school. And I think, that's still the case today in terms of schools really do, those that do well in these rankings really like to sort of promote their success in the rankings. So at that time, I'd say in the late 1990s, 2000s, Business Week was the big player in this space. US News is also now a very big player, I think. And maybe you have an opinion on this yourself, Graham, but I think US News is the ranking that many of us would consider the premium ranking at this point.
Yeah, certainly within the United States, I would say that's accurate. I think Business Week were kind of the innovators. And we should tip the hat to John Byrne, who no longer works at Business Week and runs Poets and Quants now, but he really was the brains behind Business Week's initial MBA ranking. And I believe they were the first into that market. And you're right, it was every other year. And I remember, when I was applying to business school, it was a big deal to be ranked number one in Business Week. U.S. News, who had already been doing a number of rankings, got in the game. I think they'd started with undergrad, obviously. And their ranking, I think over the years, has been a little more consistent. There have been sort of more fluctuations within Business Week and changes to the methodology. U.S. News seems to have been a bit more stable and a bit more focused on academics and acceptance criteria or kind of the caliber of the student body, whereas Business Week's ranking has always been a bit more about, hey, what do employers think of this program and what do current students and very recent graduates think about the experience? So really two different, they're really great. They both serve a purpose, but they're quite different in that market. And those two are really the ones that stood out for me for many years. They kind of ruled the roost. And I would argue then we, a few others came into the fold, I would say, shortly thereafter. And I don't know if you want to speak about, I'm thinking of Forbes and the FT and The Economist as the other big three that have kind of come into play. Do you want to say anything about any of those? Or?
Yeah, I think you're right. We sort of now think of five as the main rankings. US News, I think, still many of us consider perhaps the de facto ranking in the US. Business Week, like you say, is the innovator, John Byrne, now at Poets and Quants. Then you've got Financial Times and The Economist. I think, if I'm correct in my thinking, Graham, they also focus internationally. And Forbes as the main five rankings. And they all have slightly different methodologies, which results in different rankings. So this is where it becomes a little bit tricky for candidates who are trying to use these rankings to really get a good assessments in terms of which sort of schools to apply to. Does number one in a particular ranking mean that this is the best business school in the world? Or how should candidates use these rankings, Graham, do you think, to make those choices?
Yeah, I mean, you raise a good point. I think to someone looking at any one ranking, things can be quite, you know, confusing. I mean, in the sense that, you know, if you don't know what the underpinning methodology is, you may be looking at a ranking that's not really well suited based on your own goals or what you're hoping to, you know, get out of business school. And I will say, you know, the nice thing about there being, you know, Business Week and US News, and as you said, Forbes, Economist, FT, and that they all have slightly different approaches, means that if you look at all of them, you can begin to see a clearer picture of maybe, you know, which schools are kind of rising to the top consistently. But at the same time, if you know what's most important to you, so perhaps, you know, perhaps you're just really focused on return on investment, you might, you know, overweight your view of the Forbes ranking, which is a return on investment ranking. Literally, 5 years out, how much more money would you have made, you know, if you just stayed in your job versus gone off to the school in question, and, you know, what scenario is winning out? And so you might overweight that if return on investment is really what matters to you. Whereas, you know, obviously, if you're more focused on going to the most prestigious school with the highest caliber kind of classmates, you might look at US News, which has a lot of elements in the ranking that are kind of in tune with, you know, average test scores and GPA, and what do faculty at competing institutions think of the school in question. And so lots of more academic things going into that ranking. So yeah, I think it can be confusing because there's so many. It's like when you walk into the Gap and they have like 13 different types of jeans, it can be overwhelming. But I think, you know, obviously looking and finding the right sort of fit for you is useful. And in some cases, you know, finding a composite of all of them can be really terrific. And, you know, as we're going to discuss in this podcast, that's been done by a couple of players in our space.
Yeah, and I actually think you bring up a good point right there. These sort of composite rankings, Poets and Quants, again, John Byrne, and Fortuna, which is an admissions consulting firm, both release these sort of composite rankings, which are a composite, I believe, Graham, you can correct me, of the five previous rankings that we've discussed. And actually, if you look at those rankings, they do a reasonable job of ranking the real order of business schools, I think, which makes sense if they're sort of like taking bits of the different methodologies, in essence, to come up with their ultimate ranking. So we do have the composite rankings, which are very good. And then very recent ranking that's been released, Graham, which Wall Street Journal was a part of. Why don't you talk a little bit about that ranking? Because Wall Street Journal, obviously, is an extremely important brand. It's a well-read news source for business people. But we would agree, I think, that their ranking is pretty flawed.
You already know you're capable of greatness, but wondering just how much you can achieve isn't enough. To truly have an impact on the world, you have to go find out exactly what you're made of. It's what sets the doers apart from the merely curious. With a curriculum designed to prepare you for the global stage, plus access to all Washington, D.C. has to offer, Georgetown's McDonough School of Business is the perfect launchpad for your career. Get started at choosegeorgetown.com/MBA. Yeah, I had higher hopes. I had heard the rumors that they were working on getting back into the rankings game because they have done rankings in the past. I think they had an every other year type of ranking some 10 years ago, and they kind of scratched it and moved away from that. They, you know, so they got back into the game this year via a partnership with Times Higher Education in the UK. And so, you know, it was just released, actually, I believe, earlier this month. And yeah, the interesting thing about it is that the results did not, you know, they really didn't mirror any of the existing rankings that are out there, you know, or even the composite rankings, right? So we had Stanford at the top in that ranking, but then it just kind of, things went a little sideways. I mean, there's some terrific schools on the list, but it just wasn't really reflective. You know, the top 10 was Stanford, Cornell, Vanderbilt, Booth, Duke, then UVA, Yale, Carnegie Mellon, Purdue and Siebes. And I think, you know, something that needs to be said here is that there were a number of schools that did not participate. And I think that's part of what's happening here. If memory serves, you know, the likes of Oxford, Cambridge, LBS, MIT, Wharton, Harvard, none of them took part. And so, you know, you end up with a ranking that has some sort of missing pieces. And the other thing that struck me about this ranking is that they have what they call sort of four pillars in the ranking. It sounds pretty rational. There's kind of resources, which means, you know, faculty per student or how many career services staff there are per student. There's engagement, which is sort of like, what do students think about their interaction with faculty and would they recommend the school? How up to date is the curriculum? They have an area called outcomes, which is about, you know, how you place when you finish the MBA program, what's the difference in salary, what's the school strength in entrepreneurship, things like that. And then they have a final category called environment, which is more about percentage of international students, percentage of women, even on staff, are there many female faculty, and what's the economic diversity like within the class? So there are all these different factors. But what struck me was that there was really nothing that was based on kind of selection criteria. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, we have U.S. News that they literally incorporate like average test scores and average GPA, or, you know, there are rankings out there that maybe even look at, you know, what's the caliber of student in terms of the amount of work experience they come into the program with on average and things like that. And that was all kind of absent from this ranking. And you actually, we were kind of joking when we were reading this and kind of talking about around the office. You made a kind of I can't remember the exact analogy, but it was something about, this ranking being too dependent on just what people think of the school they're attending kind of thing, whether they're happy, you know.
Obviously, I won't repeat exactly what I said in the office, as it's probably not politically correct. But the reality is when you're not including measures of quality of the student body, it's going to impact the ranking. And unfortunately, like you say, for this particular ranking, a number of schools chose not to participate. And that's the problem I think you get when you're trying to create a new ranking. Schools sometimes want to wait it out a little bit. They want to see how the ranking develops before they choose to participate. The other rankings have actually been doing this consistently now for a number of years, and have sort of taken a foothold in this space.
I think we have reached a kind of rankings fatigue zone in the sense that, you know, I mean, we've chosen to talk about obviously this new ranking from Times Higher Education and the five big ones and some of the composites. But, you know, there are other rankings out there. QS does a ranking. There's a lot of stuff out there. And I think some candidates would be surprised to learn that most MBA programs literally have someone on staff who's like responsible for rankings. That person's not like responsible for improving their school's ranking, which is, you know, obviously many people at the institution are in theory responsible for that. But this person's like literally just responsible for like reporting, gathering data and reporting it into all the different rankings, because it is literally a full-time job at many of these schools now. And that's, you know, I don't know what that says about our, our society and things, but it is, It's a big thing, and I think schools probably chose not to participate because they literally, you know, they kind of don't have any more bandwidth to take part in these things.
Right. And to sort of swing the subject a little bit, I think we have quite a lot of experience in this space. Again, as Graham mentioned, the tools that we have on the ClearAdmit site, specifically the DecisionWire tool. And what DecisionWire and the thousands of entries we have there allows us to understand is how candidates make choices and how schools make choices. So we can understand which candidates were selected at which schools and not selected. And then given the schools that a candidate's been selected for and admitted to, we know which one they chose to attend, and we know scholarship money. So we got a lot of data points, Graham, and we have a pretty good sense, right, of how candidates make choices. And as a result from that, sort of have an understanding of how schools are ranked in a real sense.
Yeah, I think we have our kind of finger on the pulse of the customer, which is the student, and we understand kind of customer preferences and how the market is actually operating. So I think, you know, these rankings are lots of fun, and I think people get excited about them and love to compare, you know, changes from year to year or from ranking to ranking. But the reality is you know, you could have a ranking that comes out that puts a school on the top that, you know, has not traditionally been ranking there. And you know, you would look in the marketplace and not see that suddenly everyone who gets into that school is, you know, is accepting their offer and turning down offers elsewhere. So there's, yeah, we have a better handle, I think, based on the data that we are privy to, on how applicants really behave and how schools behave. You know, who are they admitting? Who are they denying, as you say? And that allows us to gut check rankings. So when we look at this Times Higher Education, Wall Street Journal ranking, or even when we look at The Economist ranking or any of them, we know kind of internally, like, gee, you know, does this make sense or not? Is this what we see candidates doing? Are they routinely turning down Stanford in favor of Booth or something? You know, is that happening in the marketplace or not? The answer is no, it's not. But yet there are plenty of rankings that might put Booth above Stanford. So it's a subject of much discussion in our, you know, in our team and around the office, because it's fascinating to watch applicant behavior.
Yeah. And so let's look at The Economist ranking for a minute, and not to pick on one of the particular rankings, we could do this with all five, but just as an example, The Economist, I believe, so correct me if I'm wrong, Graham, has number one is Booth and number two is Kellogg at Northwestern. According to DecisionWire, is Booth, are the two Chicago schools, the top two schools, would you say, based on consumer preference across the board?
No, I mean, we consistently see people choosing, you know, Harvard or Stanford or even Wharton over those two. They're right there. When we look at The Economist ranking, it doesn't really jibe with what we see candidates doing. Yeah.
Right. Again, a school tops Economist ranking, they're going to get some benefit from that. There's no doubt in my mind. But it does not mean to me, and I'm sure to yourself, Graham, that that school is now the best school in the world. And we could say the same for the Forbes ranking, for the FT, Business Week, and US News. So I guess the point I'm trying to make with the individual rankings is when they come out, it's fantastic for the schools that do well, or at least better than they expected. But candidates shouldn't read that, you know, it's in stone that though the schools at the top of that particular ranking are the best schools in the world across the board.
Right. And yeah, I think one of the fun paradoxes here is that, as you said, you know, so Booth is ranking number one in The Economist. And I mean, Chicago Booth is a terrific school, easily one of the best in the world. There's no doubt. Right. But on the one hand, they're going to shout that from the rooftops. It's going to be plastered on their website. You know, every candidate applying there is going to know that. And they're using that to their advantage. Then on the other hand, you know, you go to a GMAC conference or something, and, you know, obviously schools are often complaining about, you know, the rankings and the need to kind of provide all this data. And so I think there's this sort of interesting paradox of the schools, as you say, when they're ranked higher than they would expect or just, you know, doing well in the rankings, they promote it. And then when they're not, or you know, that when a new ranking appears, they're kind of like, we can't do this. It's too much work. It's you know, so there is that. It's a tough position to be in as a school. I mean, I think I definitely, you know, empathize with the challenge of like getting all this data together for every ranking. I think it is interesting. I will say that the other thing that's happening here as we look at these rankings, and this is something we see with the data that we have, is that schools are, they're not really ordinarily ranked, meaning they're not, you know, it's sort of unfair to put them in a straight numerical order. And I don't know if you want to talk about that in more detail, but I think that's really a critical aspect here, because here we are saying, well, is Booth the best or not? But the reality is that, you know, they have some peers. And so let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. And before we move on to that, I think full disclosure, Booth is also number one in US News, tied with Harvard, I seem to remember. So it's not just that they top The Economist ranking. They are well thought of across rankings and so forth. But Graham brings up a very good point. And again, this is something we've learned through our experience with DecisionWire, I think, although I would say that we had this sort of in our mind before we saw the data. Rather than an ordinal ranking, candidates should really look at schools within tiers. So Graham and I would argue that based off of what we've seen in Decision Wire, that Harvard and Stanford are the number one schools in either order. Would that be fair to say, Graham?
Yeah, I mean, they're sort of part of this top tier. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and for a particular candidate, Stanford might be the best choice. For another candidate, Harvard might be the best choice. But they are interchangeable in terms of their sort of overall strength.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt, I was going to say, you know, the best example of this tiering, I think, is when you look at, you know, Kellogg, Booth, MIT, and Columbia, probably. I mean, you know, that grouping.
Yeah. So once you get to that stage, so Wharton might sit behind Harvard and Stanford, but then you get into this group of Sloan, Columbia, Booth, Kellogg, and possibly Haas. And depending on an individual candidate's goals, their career goals, and even their goals as it relates to geography, and that's something else we might talk about a little bit more in a minute, any of those five schools could be a better choice than the other four. You would still argue that Stanford and Harvard would be a better choice than those five schools because they're in a tier above. But any of those five schools, depending on your career goals, your aspirations, your goals in terms of where you want to live, your geography, it could be in either order for those five potentially. And then you could say the same maybe for Tuck and Yale. You could say the same for maybe Darden, Duke, Ross, Stern, Cornell. There are definitely tiers. And what becomes more important for the individual candidate, and you can speak to this more, Graham, is, like I say, what are your goals and aspirations? Which school best fits for that? And quite frankly, where do you want to be geographically post-MBA?
Yeah, and that's probably the best. I mean, one of the like best kept secrets is, you know, the fact that like even at a school like Stanford, which many would argue, you know, one of the best in the world, I mean, a ton of people who go to Stanford end up on the West Coast. I mean, and that's, you know, maybe there's some selection, you know, self-selection there. But, you know, you look at Kellogg and Chicago, they place a lot of people in the Midwest. And do they place people in New York or California? Sure. But they place a lot of people. There's a geographical pull around each school. If you were to kind of draw a density map of like alums, even with HBS or something, you would see greater density in the Northeast Corridor for HBS and a lot of density around Chicago for Booth and Kellogg and, you know, on and on and on. And so I think people underestimate that sometimes. You know, if you're someone whose dream it is to go out west and work in the valley or something, you could argue that going to Haas is maybe a better move than going to Kellogg or Columbia or, you know, one of those other schools that, you know, obviously all similarly ranked and, you know, within the individual rankings, they move up and down. But as far as Alex and I are concerned, there's sort of a tiering happening. And so, yeah, you really have to think about, like, what is your career plan and what does the geography of the school do for you in that regard? And I think this is why we're seeing, you know, schools like University of Washington, Foster kind of creeping up in the discussion with rankings because they're in an attractive geography right now with the likes of Microsoft, Amazon, and other kind of tech companies making Seattle their home and just the general appeal of the Pacific Northwest. So I think there's a lot happening with these geographies and it's ultimately going to influence rankings over the long term.
And the geography issue actually becomes a larger issue when we're talking about how do you rank programs around the world. So some of these rankings try to do that, right? So The Economist and the Financial Times will compare directly in their rankings US schools, European schools, schools in Asia, and so forth. But we would argue that that's actually quite a difficult thing to do. And for someone, London Business School could be the number one school for that person because they want to work in London. Versus if that same person actually had aspirations to be working in the financial sector in the United States, it might well be that Stern's a better choice, right? So on the international basis, Graham, we would argue that it's very difficult to really rank these schools directly.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I mean, we've talked about this a lot, you and I, and, you know, we've talked about, gosh, you know, our INSEAD and LBS, you know, top 10 schools, if you're just lumping them in with the U.S. programs. And, you know, obviously the answer is probably, you know, depends where you want to be after you're done with the program. And I think obviously they're great schools. They, you know, they probably are in that grouping somehow, but I think where they fall in that grouping really depends on where you want to be. And I unfortunately think that, you know, the current immigration situation in the US and even in the UK with kind of Brexit looming and some changes to the postgraduate rules about, like, you know, work visas and things, that it's made things even more complicated, you know, for candidates in like India or China who are thinking, I'm going to go to get a business degree and stay in that market and work. It's kind of giving rise to opportunities in other markets, obviously, but it's complicating and sort of muddying the waters.
Absolutely. In terms of rankings overall, Graham, and obviously, you know, they become a big deal once each of these rankings is published. What is our best advice for candidates in terms of interpretation?
I have to say that looking at a composite ranking is not a bad place to start, you know, to give you a general feel. Personally, you know, I know both Fortuna and P&Q do composite rankings of the big five. They're both fine. They're actually quite similar. The one thing I would call people's attention to is that Fortuna's I like because it's just an even split across the five rankings. There's no weighting. Like, each ranking is weighted evenly. P&Q has a whole methodology, which is that, you know, U.S. News is overweighted, Economist is underweighted, and then, you know, Forbes is sort of overweighted compared to the FT and Business Week, which is a little questionable in my mind. So I think once you get into kind of weighting the different ones, it sort of defeats the purpose a little bit of a composite. And so, you know, I would say look at a composite ranking and then think about, like, what's important to you. Is it the caliber of your classmates? Is it return on investment? Is it student satisfaction? Is it what recruiters think of the institution? I mean, there are all these different possibilities. And so you could use a composite ranking to kind of make your initial list or think through, but then you might dig into one of the specific rankings as you seek to really narrow down the field, because you might say, well, what's most important to me is return on investment. So I'm going to, at the end of the day, now I have this list based on composite, I'm going to look carefully at what Forbes says, because they're really focused just on that. And I could kind of create like a seeding based on that. I would also argue that rankings should not be the end all be all, and that, you know, you've got to be really careful to think about what Alex and I have just been talking about, which is this idea of tiering. You know, people who get on discussion forums and argue till they're blue in the face that, like, MIT is better than Kellogg, which is better than Booth, which is better than Columbia, you know, it's sort of ridiculous. There comes a point where it depends on the candidate and what they want to do. And so I would say, you know, use rankings at the beginning to kind of build a large sort of target group, but don't get carried away, and recognize that, you know, that many of these schools are really grouped together. Despite, obviously, that wouldn't sell. Like, a ranking that said, you know, here, these couple of schools are on top, this next batch of five are pretty even, this next batch of six are more or less the same. Like, that's not interesting, right? There's no drama in that. And so, you know, keep that in mind. Like, I really think that it depends on the candidate. And then the last thing I would say is, you know, talk to students, go and visit these schools. Like, that's obviously really important too. And just know that rankings are just one piece of this puzzle. We're seeing everything nowadays. I mean, obviously, we have five big rankings and a whole bunch of others that are on the scene. We've got composite rankings that just combine all the existing rankings. And then the other day, I saw an interesting article, I think it was on LinkedIn, a gentleman who used to work at the FT, he now works at ESMT, which is a business school in Berlin, Germany. He did a survey in which he did a ranking of the ranking methodologies. So he asked schools who participate in the rankings to kind of say, well, what do you think? You know, how do they run their process? How influential is their ranking? Are you happy with the ranking, et cetera? And so, lo and behold, the FT did incredibly well in that survey. And the first thing I thought, and I'm sure this guy's a great guy, and, you know, but I think, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, well, look, this guy worked at the FT for many years, and it so happens that the FT has been pretty kind to ESMT, where he works now. So, you know, you have to take these things with a grain of salt. But I do like the concept that he has, which is, Well, let's go to the people who are actually participating in these rankings and see what they think of the way that, you know, Business Week or The Economist go about gathering their data. Does it seem like it's a tightly run ship? Is it haphazard? Are they getting audited? Like, how well done is this? And so that was kind of interesting too. And I encourage people to look at that. As you might expect, it was kind of the FT and US News sort of topping the list in most cases. But in any event, that was kind of a fun thing. But, you know, there's like an endless supply of this stuff. And, you know, again, you got to take it with a grain of salt, even though it is fun to follow.
Yeah. And I think what rankings do for candidates, sort of in your initial research, they help frame the marketplace as such, help you really understand, well, which are the better schools or perceived to be the better schools, and where do I fit in this scale so I can figure out the particular schools to which to apply. But I think there's definitely some issues with the fluctuations of these individual rankings. I would say that there's no ranking, certainly over recent memory, that's got numbers 1, 2, and 3 exactly right, which is puzzling to me. So, you know, I would argue that a ranking that doesn't have either Harvard and Stanford as number one is problematic. Business Week and Financial Times currently have Stanford at number one, and US News currently has Harvard at number one, which is fantastic, but none of those rankings then has the other school at number two, right, and Wharton at number three. So it's problematic, I think, if you focus it from a consumer's choice standpoint, which is our point of view and our experience, where people choose to go based on the choices that they have. And at the end of the day, again, as Graham said, tiers is the way to think of it. Many schools are equally competitive. Just depends on your own particular circumstances and goals that should help you understand how you prioritize then those particular schools that are within a tier. So we've basically covered at least two tiers, the sort of the Columbia, Haas, Booth, Kellogg, Sloan tier, and the sort of Darden, Duke, Ross, Stern, Cornell, Anderson possibly in that tier. You know, these schools are tightly marked from a competitive standpoint. So depending on your goals, your geography preference, and so on and so forth, that should drive your choice, not a particular position in a particular ranking.
Yeah, well said. Yeah, and I think ideally folks listen to this and get some insight and you know, take what they read with a grain of salt, and also think about, as we've been stressing, this idea of tiers and, you know, this idea of kind of consumer preference and where people are deciding to go. Yeah, I really appreciate talking about this with you. I mean, obviously, we could probably go on for hours in terms of there's just so much to unpack. And we'll probably get in trouble, you know, for some of the things we say here. But that's what it is. You know, that's what we try to be about on the Clear Admit podcast. So, yeah. So thanks so much. And stay tuned for more episodes. We've got a lot of great guests that we're lining up for future episodes. And thanks so much for joining me, Alex. And we'll see you next time, probably.
Yeah, and best of luck to everybody making decisions on schools to apply, and then when they've got their results, which schools to attend, because that's what this particular podcast should hopefully help you guide making some of those decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again, Alex.
Very good. Thank you, Graham.